Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, the makers of the upcoming Jaws-inspired documentary, The Shark Is Still Working, Jake Gove, Eric Hollander, James Gillette, and Michael Roddy, plus the director of Your Mommy Kills Animals, the highly anticipated documentary on the animal rights movement, Mr. Kurt Johnson. And in honor of their special New York City opening this coming weekend, a special clip from our archive featuring director Anthony Giacchino and John Swinglish from the Camden 28. Have a question for any of our guests? Drop us a line at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com at any time during the show. Sit back, turn it up, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome to a very special Wednesday night episode of Movie Geeks United. We have a great, great show for you tonight. Jerry, fellow co-host Jerry, will be joining us halfway through the show. And Chris is sitting this one out tonight, but he'll be back with us Sunday night for our 6 p.m. Eastern time slot. An exciting show for you guys tonight. Just a couple of program notes. We have a lot of guests, a lot of lines that are live. We can only have 5 live lines on at a time on the Blog Talk Radio system. So we cannot accommodate any callers with any questions, at least for this first part of the show. But you can submit your questions via email at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. We'll be checking it throughout this segment, and make sure you include your name so we can give you credit for your question. Also, I want to point you in the direction of the left-hand or the right-hand side of your screen on the Blog Talk Radio page, where you'll see the iTunes icon. We are now available on iTunes. You can download all of our episodes on iTunes. I really urge you to do that. It's a great service, and it's absolutely free. You can also find backlogs of links for all 16 of our shows on our MySpace page, myspace.com/MovieGeeksUnited, where you can click and you can listen to our two-hour tribute shows to Brian De Palma, Al Pacino, David Lynch, as well as a recent interview we did just last week with Spencer Garrett, who is a co-star of I Know Who Killed Me, which opens this Friday. And he had some interesting things to say about not only his working experience with Lindsay Lohan, who is getting a lot of press lately, but also about an upcoming fall release that we're really looking forward to, and that's Charlie Wilson's War with Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts. That's one of the most highly anticipated films of the fall, so you can get the scoop on that. Just go to our MySpace page, and it will be available for you on there. Okay, we begin tonight's program with a discussion on one of the most popular and beloved films in the history of cinema and the new documentary work that explores its ongoing legacy. In 1974, a young director by the name of Steven Spielberg was signed to direct a film version of the popular Peter Benchley novel, Jaws. The production that followed has been recorded as one of the industry's most colorful, cumbersome, and calamitous. But what resulted was nothing short of a cinematic masterpiece, a classic that continues to delight, frighten, and transport audiences more than 30 years after its initial release. Now in a new documentary effort titled The Shark Is Still Working, filmmakers Jake Gove, Eric Hollander, James Gillette, and Michael Roddy explore every facet of the worldwide phenomenon that is Jaws. It is my great pleasure to welcome all 4 of these terrific filmmakers to our show. Gentlemen, are you there?
Hi, Jamie.
Hi, how are you? It's a pleasure to have all of you here. I think that we're missing one person, and that is Michael, but I assume he'll be calling in any minute now.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Jake. I'm here.
Hey, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
First to you, Eric, and I want to ask this of all of you. What was it about Jaws that first spoke to you when you saw it, I assume, as a kid? And how has the appreciation and experience of that film deepened for you over the years?
Well, I would have to say that Jaws has been more of a life experience for me than just merely a favorite film. And that may sound kind of strange to people who aren't movie geeks, but I was actually 12 when I saw the movie in its re-release back in 78 because I was deemed too young to see it at the time of its initial release. And during that period, I was in fourth grade when the film came out in 75. And because I was forbidden to see it, there was this kind of mythos that I built up in my head about it. Everybody else was seeing it, all my friends. It was the playground chatter for the whole year. And so I just kind of, played the game, that I had seen it. Because, when you're a kid, it's a status thing,
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big deal to me that, I wasn't able to see this film, but I wanted everyone to think I had. So I conjured up this whole thing, and I would sit out there and talk about this movie I hadn't seen. And then for 4 years, I just became more and more obsessed. And finally, when I was able to see it in the re-release, it exceeded everything that I had ever built up in my mind, which is quite a thing to do.
That's rare. Yeah.
And ever since that time, it's just been part of my subconscious. It's strange. I can't really describe it. It's just been a part of my life, and I when it came on network television, I recorded it off TV on an audio cassette, and memorized it, over the following years, and it just, what can I say?
Yeah.
So I always had a connection with Jaws, and so it was the obvious choice for me when I got into production and ever came up with an idea to do a documentary. This is what it's going to be about.
Exactly. Yeah, Jake, how about you?
Well, for me, I did see it when I was a child, and obviously, when you're a kid and you see a movie like that, it scares you, disturbs you greatly. I had a great fear of the water after seeing that, no matter what kind of body of water I was in, whether it be a lake or a swimming pool or even a bathtub, places where there's no sharks, obviously, but I was still afraid of it. And then, so I always loved the film, and as the years went by, when I got into college and took some film studies classes and revisited Jaws again, I start to appreciate it on a different level for the performances and the story and the structure and the suspense and the characterization and everything. And so what I did in 94 is I went down to the Jaws ride at Universal Studios Florida, and that kind of really pushed me over the edge. And I was just getting on the internet at the time, and I got on there, and the first thing I looked for was Jaws, and there wasn't any Jaws website, so I decided to make a Jaws website, the very first one, JawsMovie.com, and throughout the years, I've just kept that site running, and my appreciation for the film has grown as I've met, a community, internet community of fans of the film, and pointed out things I never noticed, and
mm-hmm.
It's just been a fascinating thing that I've been doing now, this website, for, 13 years now.
It is one of those films that you can keep going back to, and it keeps giving you something else.
Uh-huh.
There's just a wealth of things to enjoy in that film, and observations and insights.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, James, how about you? How has Jaws changed your life?
Well, my story is quite a bit different than most people's, and comes as a surprise to a lot of people. First of all, I'm the youngest of the group by quite a few years. I was born in '71, so December of '71. So I was only 3 when the movie came out. And what's surprising to a lot of people is even though I grew up a big movie fan and a big Spielberg fan, somehow I made it to the age of 19 before I saw Jaws.
Mm.
Therefore, my first Jaws experience was a VHS deal, pan and scan, probably a 25-inch TV. Turns out, Eric and Michael and I have all been friends since the 80s. We've all known each other collectively since 1988. And they were the ones that inflicted Jaws on me for the first time. And of course, I just fell in love with it. I thought it was great. It was instantly one of my favorite movies, even though I didn't see it in the theater. But the moment when I really became hugely passionate about it was not. It did not come from the movie itself. It came from when I saw Laurent Bouzereau's documentary on the making of the movie. At that point, I became really passionate about the process of filmmaking. I mean, the actual process of mm-hmm. getting it done and starting and overcoming obstacles and things like that. That's when I went really nuts, and that's when I decided I would just want to cover that process, as a career, and that's what makes The Sharkest a Working, kind of a dream project for me here.
Yeah, absolutely.
The movie itself, and of course I do love it. I would say that out of the 4 of us, I probably am the least passionate about the movie itself, although I am passionate about it to a certain extent. But you're right. It's one of those movies where you do bring something new away from it each time.
Mm-hmm.
And just we just talked to M. Night Shyamalan about it a few nights ago, and he's talking about, I mean, it's really the one movie, and I completely agreed with him, and I never heard it quite put that way, but it's the one movie that gives you just at a perfect level just all the different ingredients and shades from a movie that you would want, you know, as far as humor and character development and
yeah.
scares, and it just kind of keeps you strung along perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely want to discuss some of these guests that you have taking part in this documentary. It's such an impressive lineup of talent. Jake, did this project originally start, did I read correctly, as a very simple documentary on the Jaws Fest experience, and then it ballooned from there?
Well, actually, yeah. I met Eric, James, and Michael through my JawsMovie.com website, and Jaws Fest was coming about, and I had known these guys for years. And they actually contacted me about a documentary that they were going to do about Jaws Fest. And at the time, I was planning on my own, much smaller scale, to go to Jaws Fest on my own and bring a camera and kind of document the proceedings there myself and for my website. But once they told me what they had in mind, it kind of blew my idea out of the water. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I became involved with these guys. And then and once we got to Jaws Fest, and a lot of the other guys can speak to a lot of the amazing things that started happening to us, and it became much more than a documentary of just a bit of the fan gathering.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eric, I know that there's already an exceptional documentary on the production of the film that was included on the special edition DVD a few years back. But what did you see that you could bring to the subject that was new and unique and most of all necessary?
Well, you know, when we first started really pursuing the idea of making a full-orbed Everything Jaws documentary, as opposed to just about the fans, our biggest dream, our goal, was to make something that would be kind of a bookend to Laurent Bouzereau's work, because we weren't trying to reinvent the wheel. We never had in mind to do just simply another making of, because there have been a number of documentaries and specials that have aired on Discovery and on E! And other networks on Jaws, which again speaks to its longevity. I mean, they're still generating productions about Jaws, you know, 30 years later. But we didn't want to retread the same ground. At least not at length. I mean, there is some of that, because you have to kind of establish for people who haven't seen it. But we just decided we wanted to pick up where Laurent had left off, basically. You know, obviously this film has just touched our culture in just virtually every way you can imagine. And it seems kind of random. A movie about a killer shark would have that big an impact on culture, but it really has. And not just in terms of being the first blockbuster and kind of the ways that people automatically think of when they think of Jaws, big summer movies and that sort of thing. But, I mean, it really impacted, you know, even right down to actual shark science, you know, the way people view the plight of the great white shark or you know, the study of sharks in general. Mm-hmm. Shark Week was, I believe, an eventual you know, love child of Jaws in our culture. So, I mean, it was just something we really wanted to do, and it wasn't really anything that we had an outline for. It was kind of it invented itself as it went along.
Right.
And then when Michael Roddy got on board, and he had some connections at Universal because he works Universal Orlando, he was able to secure some very big A-list you know, veterans from Jaws early on, and it was then that we realized, okay, we're going to be able to see this through. I mean, this, you know, once we had Steven Spielberg, I mean, all bets were off. We could get virtually anybody we wanted. And it really just kind of it built its own momentum. It really did.
Wasn't Roy Scheider kind of instrumental in getting the ball rolling in a large way?
He was, in the sense that he really gave us a lot of credibility when we moved to the other people. Roy Scheider was the first of the A-list people that we did interview. He was very enthusiastic, interested in the project, and we even asked him at the time, when we had done the interview, we asked him, you know, could we use your name, could we credit you as associate producer, just in terms of having your name on this project will give us credibility. He said sure, and he was happy to do it, and when we went to Mr. Spielberg, the first question he asked was, who have you guys got? You know, who'd you get? And we were able to say, you know, Roy Scheider, and we had already had Joe Alves and Carl Gottlieb and a few others. And I think, yeah, it was kind of snowballed. It really did. And of course, later when it was done and we were in the post-production phase, Roy Scheider again came into the picture, and he asked us if he could narrate it. I mean, he approached us about it. And, of course, when Chief Brody says, hey, would you like me to narrate the movie you're doing about the film that I was the lead in, you say yes, and you do it. And it
exactly,
was an
yeah.
awesome experience.
The funny addition to that part of it is we had as a group, when we were – actually, first of all, we were even trying to decide whether or not we wanted narration at all. Like, we were going to, for a while, try to do this without any narration. And then when we decided we needed it, we started thinking, okay, who can we get? Who would we want? Who would be our dream list? And Roy Scheider came up, and our opinion was, well, that just wouldn't seem quite right to have somebody, you know, who was in Jaws referring to this stuff in the third person. It would just seem really weird, you know. That's just kind of what we thought. But like Eric said, when the man himself brings it up, that's when you back up and say, okay, our opinion sucks. Who cares what we think? If he's interested, he's doing it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I agree.
And he does amazing voice work. I mean, usually, yeah. You know, he's done many documentaries in the past, and I knew that. But, again, the reason we didn't consider him earlier was simply because we thought it would be strange for someone in the documentary to also be narrating in third person. But it worked out beautifully. It really.
So Jake.
We just had to tailor the script a little bit, just slightly, to make it work, but that really wasn't hard at all.
Mm-hmm. So you actually met with Spielberg fairly early in the process, Jake?
Yes, we did, actually. That was actually my first production trip with the guys. We had booked our production trip out to L.A. to do a bunch of different interviews, and there was a chance at the time that we were going to get Spielberg, but, you know, we didn't know because he's, you know, the most famous director in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And then once we got out there, we found out right away that we did have him, and we had him for 2 hours when he was taking time out of his busy schedule while he was working on post-production and the scoring of The War of the Worlds. He sat down with us and gave us, you know, some really amazing stuff, and he actually asked us if we had been able to get John Williams into the documentary, and we hadn't been able to set that up yet, and he said, oh, John's just down the hall, and, you know, one thing led to another, and John Williams was in our documentary as a result of us meeting with Steven Spielberg.
I can't imagine how giddy you guys must have been.
I brought him in the room.
It was surreal.
I know that the title of the film is a play on the much dreaded phrase that permeated the set, the shark is not working.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the story behind that has to be one of the happiest accidents in the history of cinema. And I think that's a big strength of Spielberg's, is that he can take accidents and he can use them to his advantage.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Eric, how much does he attribute the fact that the shark often did not work to the ultimate success of his film?
He's very open and candid about it. You know, I guess a lesser director would be more insecure and probably try to posture that, you know, that was their intention all along, but he really doesn't. And he's also gone on record many times in his career that, you know, Jaws was the most nightmarish production experience he ever had. In fact, claims he still has night sweats thinking about it, going back in his mind. So he, you know, he had an experience that was apocalyptic at that time in his life. But equally as difficult as it was rewarding in a way that, you know, very few directors have ever seen. I mean, literally gave him the clout to make any movie he wanted after that. And so I really believe that there is a very special place in his heart for this film for that reason. But at the same time, it's probably a love-hate relationship that he has with Jaws. A hate of the actual memories of it, but a love for what it did for his career.
Well, if you think of it, too, I mean, he had kind of extensive television directing credits, and he did the television movie Duel, which he's referred to as the perfect kind of precursor to Jaws.
Yes, yeah.
And he did the Sugarland Express.
Yeah, and he'd done some Night Gallery episodes as well.
Yeah, was there, so he's almost a newbie for this size of production. at that
time. This was a second feature film. You know, Sugarland was, and what's unusual, Sugarland Express was his first, but it really wasn't a box office hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of amazing that he got this gig.
Was there any wariness on the part of the principal cast and crew, or did they get Spielberg right off the bat?
I think the people who counted got Spielberg. Mm-hmm. I think Zanuck and Brown, who had been producers on Sugarland Express, saw that talent that he had in that film, and knew that if he was given the right material,
mm-hmm.
and the right budget and the right, you know, creative license, what he could do. And of course, they were right spot on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the greatest investment in trust,
yeah.
in a human being you could make, you know.
Absolutely. James, I'm fascinated by Robert Shaw's performance in the film. And I know Richard Dreyfuss is an exceptional storyteller, especially when he's talking about Robert Shaw. What kind of presence was Robert Shaw on that set?
On the set itself, well, Richard Dreyfuss, like you already mentioned, is probably the very best guy to talk about the presence of Robert Shaw.
Uh-huh.
Just in that, Robert Shaw kind of established the culture between the two, which the culture between the two in the movie was very much like the culture between the two in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Shaw was very competitive. He nagged Richard Dreyfuss constantly, to try to get under his skin and just. Figure out ways to frustrate him. He felt Richard Dreyfuss was a little bit, full of himself, in that stage of his career. He was kind of young, and he came off of a couple of successful movies, and just probably just kind of had a very self-flattering way about him. So Robert Shaw would take whatever opportunities he could to. As Roy Scheider says in our documentary, to slap Richard Dreyfuss down from time to time. Not physically, but mentally.
Right.
So the way Richard Dreyfuss talks about it in our documentary is, oh my gosh, Robert Shaw, he terrified me. He intimidated me. He was all over me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But since he was Robert Shaw, I couldn't help but worship the guy.
Yeah.
He was such an amazing actor. He was an amazing, amazing artist, amazing writer. And he, anybody who talks about him, whether it be on Jaws or any other movie he did, just talks about the kind of presence that Robert Shaw carried around with him. It's just, he could be five rooms away, and he'd be lighting up the room you're in,
Yeah.
He was just that kind of guy.
And I know Spielberg was looking for that, because I read about his short list of choices for that role, and it was Lee Marvin and
Sterling Hayden.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking for that presence, and Robert Shaw is just electrifying. In that,
David Brown stepped in because Zanuck and Brown produced The Sting,
uh-huh.
Which Robert Shaw was in, and David Brown stepped in and said, "I think Robert Shaw's our man."
Mm. Jake, do you have a sense? Were you able to get a sense of what Jaws means to people, not only in the U.S. but around the world?
Well, we had quite a few Jaws fans that we met at Jaws Fest or from other countries and things like that. And it's just kind of a universal film.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, pun not intended there. It is a universal film. But because, thank Peter Benchley for this. He captured a primal fear that everybody in the world is afraid of what's underneath the water.
Mm.
So the movie connected with so many people around the world on that level that you can't – it's just a fear thing, and then it's just kind of an amazing thing, and that's why it's so beloved around the world. And I would say that, on my JawsMovie.com site, it's become, we have a ton of people from other countries on there all the time, primarily Great Britain, but there's Australia and South American countries and things like that. There's just tons of people from around the world that love this film. So it was rare, and we actually had some footage of from back in screenings in Japan back in the 70s, and it's the same kind of thing. It's the movie just touched everyone around the world. And David Brown, I believe, talks about when they would go on and visit with other audiences around the world, and they just saw that this film was connecting with everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Steven Spielberg had a great line that was once upon a time in the documentary, and we eventually ended up having to lift it, like so many other wonderful lines. Unfortunately, you know, we had to cut so much wonderful, just pure 24-karat gold just to get the documentary down to the 3 hours that it is. But Spielberg said that some of the best business in the entire world came from these landlocked nations, you know, like way in the middle of the bush of Africa,
right,
where, you know, you're like miles and miles, just hundreds of miles away from any body of water at all.
Way,
and yet they love the Jaws there anyway.
I wanted to ask you about that, too, because I know you have said that you have a lot of tidbits of information in here that are like jewels to Jaws fans or fans of movies in general, and you don't want to give them away before the film gets a release. But what kind of juicy tidbits ended up on the cutting room floor?
Well, ended up on the floor, there's plenty that are in there that people are already kind of aware about, you know, just from being on the internet, word leaks out. And there have been screeners. There have been reviewers that have kind of spilled some.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
there was that one story that Dreyfuss told us about the Indianapolis survivor. We haven't talked about this
good.
In a long time. Dreyfuss told a great story. We were talking about the Indianapolis, which was the cruiser, you know, of course, the Hiroshima bomb that Robert Shaw's character was on. And,
right.
Which a lot of America learned about that event in history for the first time thanks to Jaws. So we thought, well, this definitely deserves some attention in our documentary if we're talking about the legacy of this thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Dreyfuss told a story about a survivor from the Indianapolis who... 6 months. I mean, of course, he was retired from active service, but he worked 6 months out of the year as a garbage man, and then the other 6 months of the year, he would rent out a charter boat and just go out and kill sharks. Six months a year, and of course, the way Richard Dreyfuss told him, he does his voices and his accents, and you know, he made it a lot of fun, but. That was pretty phenomenal stuff, and that's unfortunately not in there anymore.
Wow. James, what's the game plan in terms of distribution? Where are you guys at now?
I'm afraid you were going to ask.
No, we just had our first official discussions with who we are hoping will be our distribution representative. Yesterday we had that talk. We decided we have our first and only choice for distribution representative. We're going to wait until we know for sure what their decision is going to be before we try to find anybody else. But we were very encouraged by our talk yesterday.
So you feel kind of positive that the fans that have been clamoring for this for so long now, it'll be in their hands or they'll be able to go see it pretty soon?
Oh, man, I hope
We certainly hope so.
Yeah.
We're really starting to feel like... kind of like Spielberg during the making of Jaws, you know, keeping the entire cast and crew hostage on this island, and there's nothing they can do about it.
Yeah, well,
it's going on and on and on forever.
The anticipation.
We can promise that it will be worth the wait. That's the only thing we can definitely promise at this point.
Oh, I bet it will be. I bet it will be.
I mean, we have exclusive, not just interviews, but footage and pictures, photos from the archive at Universal, never been seen ever before. Video footage, film footage from the shoot. You name it. I mean, it's just full of
new
stuff.
If you look at the level that it's produced at, like if you go to our website and you watch the new trailer, and you look at the level that trailer is produced at, just imagine 3 hours of that. You know,
it's an amazing trailer.
It's full of texture. I mean, it's a very visually dynamic documentary. It's so much so that you completely forget that you're watching what could be classified as a talking head presentation. You know,
and a wealth of filmmakers speaking to how Jaws influenced them and changed their lives too.
Well, was obviously that's a key dynamic of a video that's, you know, talking about the retro, you know, the power of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, one of the byproducts of Jaws' power in our culture is it has influenced so many people to become filmmakers, and some who have become enormously successful and gone on to make their own, you know, classics, modern day classics,
mm-hmm.
and you know, some are just outright famous for being Jaws fans. You know, Bryan Singer's production company is named Bad Hat Harry after the scene in Jaws, and Kevin Smith. We have a scene in the documentary where we talk about Kevin puts little, you know, nods to Jaws in some of his films, names characters after Brody and Hooper and Quint.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, that was an important, that was something we knew from the very beginning we wanted to do. And we were very fortunate. Just about everybody we sought after we got. The one exception has been, unfortunately, Steven Soderbergh, who is an enormous Jaws fan, but he wanted to do an interview, and then we just couldn't connect our schedules.
Mm.
So we're still trying, because the one good thing about being in a holding pattern is it's given us a little bit of time to add a few new interviews, including M. Night Shyamalan, who we just
did
a few days ago, yeah.
Well, we cannot wait to see this film, and when you have a deal and you have details about distribution, please come back and speak with us, because give us an update, because we're just our anticipation is at a fever pitch, and we'd love to speak with you.
We'll be glad to.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sure, Jamie.
The film is called The Shark is Still Working, and it looks like it's going to be picked up for distribution pretty soon, so all those Jaws fans and really all movie geeks will be able to feast their eyes on that film pretty soon, hopefully. Fingers crossed. Now we have Movie Geeks United fellow co-hosts Chris and Jerry both on the line. Gentlemen?
Hey, what's up?
It's Richard Dreyfuss!
Richard Dreyfuss? Oh, my God!
Doesn't he do a good Richard Dreyfuss impression?
He does. He really does.
It's very.
The best thing about this movie is the title. I haven't seen the movie. I don't say the best thing about the movie is the title, but the fact that it's called The Shark is Still Working, because the fucking movie is still working 30
yeah.
years later.
Yeah,
it hasn't lost
it's
anything.
Incredible.
It has not aged a minute.
No,
it's
getting better
working.
With each viewing, I think.
Oh, it absolutely does.
It's just one of those films. Yeah. And, you know, reading about this film for as long as I have, which has been the better part of a year as far as I can remember, I mean, you're just salivating. You want to see it right now.
Yeah, I know.
And I know that they're aware of that, but they're taking their time to deliver the most comprehensive project that they can to the Jaws fans out there. So that's going to be an amazing movie. How have you guys been since the big De Palma tribute Sunday night?
Okay.
I've been pretty good. I've been caught up in the Lost DVDs, so I've been watching Lost. So
you have been lost.
You have
completely
really
lost in that show. God, I love it. It's so great.
How about you, Jerry?
Oh, I've just been chilling out. I mean, you know, Brian and I will probably be connected at the hip till, you know, the day I die. So
well, you see like three movies a night. Have you? So that. You must have seen nine movies since the
Palmetry. I think nine movies. But I didn't see three movies a night, though, because you have to take a break. But I will say this, and this will probably destroy any credibility I have left. I'm really in love with Nancy Allen, so we'll just leave it at that.
Hey, we all. Is this a boyhood crush, or?
Oh, it keeps getting. I think with each like blowout viewing, or even RoboCop for that matter, it just gets worse.
Yeah.
Really, I'm just tempted to go buy a ring right now.
You know, I used to, when I was a kid, I used to feel that way about Olivia Newton-John.
There you go.
Yeah, and now I hear her music and it makes me want to vomit. But back then, as a kid, that was my first real crush. All right, gentlemen, and with that, our next guest is on the line. Variety Magazine calls it a miraculously even-handed treatment of a snarlingly divisive debate. And one critic from Cinephilia.com proclaims, it's the bravest American movie I've ever seen. This is just a small sampling of the praise that our next guest is receiving for his new feature-length documentary, Your Mommy Kills Animals, a balanced and open-eyed look at the complex and polarizing world of the animal rights movement. The film was just picked up for worldwide theatrical and video distribution a mere 2 weeks ago by Halo 8 Entertainment, but it's already one of the most buzzed about and highly anticipated documentary events of the year. This is just the latest acclaimed project to grace writer, producer, director Kurt Johnson's already remarkable resume, which includes writing credits on shows like Titus, Now and Again, and The Pretender, as well as producing duties on Common Threads, Stories from the Quilt, Michael Moore Hates America, and Toth, a documentary short that won the 2002 Academy Award. We have an Academy Award winner.
I know.
Oh.
That's amazing. It is a great privilege to welcome Kurt Johnson to our show to discuss this new film. Mr. Johnson?
I was like, Christ, thank you for the PR. Damn.
It's great to have you on the show. I wanted to give you an intro that was worthy of...
Oh, thank you. I'm like, damn.
tell me a little bit about this project. What was the genesis of this project for you, and what made you think it should not only be your next project, but your first directorial effort?
My curiosity, literally. It was just kind of like, you know, seeing on... It was a link to CNN on Drudge Report about they were being, you know, that they were listed as one of the top domestic terrorist threats in the country, which is animal rights activists. So, and for a couple of years, you know, some people had said, you know, oh, they're kind of wacko, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I guess put all that together, I was just like, I wonder what's going on with that. So it kind of came from just my own, like, what the hell is going on?
So have you been, you weren't active in the animal rights movement before this film, or?
Oh, no. I was never, I never was an animal rights activist now. I was just kind of curious. And every time, when I started watching various documentaries on the animal rights movement, I noticed that they were either one side or the other side. Mm-hmm. There was never, like, one that kind of went down the middle.
Right.
And after the experience, I can understand why.
it's
been crazy.
I want to hear about that experience. First of all, why are they considered one of our top domestic terror threats?
Well, you know, there's some people that do have gone, you know, it's like in any movement, you have some that go really extreme. So you've got some people out there who've done the pipe bombs and set off things. And, you know, when you're doing that and you're setting off firebombs, of course that's going to get get the FBI's attention.
Yeah.
You know, and what happens is you always have, like, just a couple people who go to a further extreme, and basically everyone kind of pays for it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where I kind of, like, at times, you know, it's like some of the people in the movement, there's some really great people in the movement. There's some that are really passionate. And, you know, it's just kind of a shame that, you know, some who, you know, and sometimes, you know, any movement, if you're going to attract some people that just want to, you know, beat shit up sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I don't know if they're doing it for the animals or whatever. And then the rest of the movement has to pay for that. And that's kind of the interesting thing I found. Like, sitting through the Shaq 7 trial, it was just kind of like, wow, some of these people that have gone really too far, they're actually messing up free speech for everybody else and for, like, a lot of future movements, you know.
Tell me about the Shaq. Tell me about the Shaq group for those of the listening audience that aren't aware of it.
Oh, that's a movement. It's called Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, and it's an interesting grassroots effort where they basically focused on one medical research facility called Huntington Life Sciences, started over in London, and there was a Shaq group that started there, and then Huntington also moved to New Jersey, and then Shaq followed them. Another, you know, it was kind of like they just started cropping up, and what they would do is they would protest, but then they would also go after anyone who did business with Huntington Life Sciences. I mean, even vendors, like toilet paper vendors down that low, they would go to their homes and protest. And eventually, you know, like, if, you know, you've got neighbors and you've got a lot of activists outside your home saying puppy killer, you know, you're going to be like, is it really worth doing business with this company? And they were very effective because they also had a hand in keeping the company from being listed on the New York Stock Exchange, which was the first time in American history that it ever happened due to political pressure.
Mm.
You know, and again, it was a grassroots effort, and you're kind of like, wow, it's impressive as a grassroots effort that they have that much passion.
Yeah, and that much power. you know, I think all of us can sympathize with the cruelty to animals debate.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there are some pure-hearted kind of ideals you can come to with a pure heart, but it can kind of easily deform into extremism. And I think an example of that is what inspired the title of your film. I've seen this comic book that was published by PETA.
You saw it in 2003 when it came out.
Oh, has it been edited since 2003? Or?
It was out in 2003. That's when it made the big splash.
That must have been the book that I just downloaded last week.
Okay. Yeah, the picture in the poster, it's been modified. Because I was always like, it should be more Mildred Pierce-y looking.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I just always thought that, and I know. And so the guy that designed the poster, he incorporated the comic book into it, because I don't know if you've seen the poster that's on the website.
Right.
You know, yourmommykillsanimals.com. It's a protester, an ALFE kind of protester holding up the sign.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think the Mildred Pierce look is a little more effective.
So tell me about this comic book, because I've seen it, but tell our listeners a little bit about this.
It was a comic book, and from my understanding of what people had talked about, was that it was handed out to to children, and from what various people said, it was as young as 6 years old. And, you know, and again, I'm not about to censor people, but I'm like, ooh, that just, you know, if you're handing it out to, like, 16-year-olds, it's like, they're going to kind of get it, the humor of it.
Right.
But I don't know, when you go that young, that's a little freaky, especially on the back of it when you read it. You know, it's like, some of our furry friends, blah, 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 you know, and one of those, you know, basically your mommy is killing our furry little friends.
And it shows it shows a skinned animal, which, yeah.
Yeah. That's bound to freak you out if you're a kid, because I remember, like, watching horror films as a kid, and that's that stuff stays with you.
Our previous guests are making the documentary film about the impact of Jaws, and they spoke to seeing Jaws when they were little. that petrified them. So I can't imagine what this comic book did.
Yeah. Well, even when we were handing out buttons, because the promo materials we hand out at film festivals are like buttons with some of the imagery. And we have a 6-foot bunny, and my regulation for the bunny was just to, like, just 16 and up, don't hand them out to kids, because I just I don't want to, you know, some kid like 10 years down the line, Kurt Johnson, messed my life up, you know. That's all I need. That button messed me up.
Yeah. Now your film has been getting raves, mostly because it is an incredibly balanced examination of this issue. Was that always a mission of yours when you set out to direct this film, to tell all sides without judgment?
Everything I do, yeah. I learned a lot from Sarah Kernachan on Thoth, and I give her so much, because she won an Oscar way back when she was 21 for Marjo.
Mm-hmm.
And by learning from her about, you just let the subject talk, and you don't need to get in there and put my opinion in. And so I learned from her, and I find it more interesting. I got to say, it's more challenging, because, you know, when you don't put yourself in the film and you don't do the voiceover stuff,
mm-hmm.
it's hard. You know, it's challenging, but it's kind of cool to let everyone else tell the story, but also letting each side talk equally. And the thing that's hard, though, is when you're out there trying to get interviews and you explain to everyone and you're just being, you know, upfront saying, listen, I'm talking to everybody on both sides.
Right.
They kind of look at you. You'll get sometimes where the more open you're being about what your mission is with the film, it seems sometimes the more they're kind of like looking at you like, what's the game?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're expecting you. They're it's like, if I went to one side, I'm going to make you look good. It seems like it would have been easier than by saying, you know, I'm going to talk to people on the other side. The people mm-hmm. that are against you, I'm talking to them too. And it just seemed to kind of like some people got very nervous. And I think also after seeing kind of what some of the activists have been put through, you know, like when you have like your wiretapped and your life is, you know, you have friends who you think are friends who are actually paid informants to be your friends, I can understand why you're so nervous, because you just don't know who to trust, and I can understand that part.
Absolutely, and I know it must be challenging, because to take out any personal points of view in the film. And, you know, that's what we're missing in a lot of documentary filmmaking. And even the news on television, the so-called debate shows that drown each other out. And as good of a filmmaker that Michael Moore is, that's definitely something that's missing from his so-called documentary work.
Well, his stuff is, I think, you know, on Michael Moore Hates America, I did an interview with Annie Cole News. And people seem more shocked that everyone's like, oh, so you hate him. It's like, no. I mean, it's thank God there's somebody like him out there who at least gets issues out there. I mean, he may polarize and all of that and do his thing, but at least he gets certain issues out there and people aware. You know, I don't agree with everything the way he does it, and I learned a lot working on Michael Moore Hates America, but, you know, it's like he's free to do that, you know, and that was the message of Michael Moore Hates America for me going into it, because I was brought in to work on that film. It was more about, like, can you keep your objectivity in documentary filmmaking? And in that film, the director goes the route of Michael Moore three times in the film. And that was important to me to show that, how easy it is to go that route, because it's easier. I mean, Jesus, I mean, there's times, I'm sure, like, you've had an interview, you probably had some interview, and you're like, God, you know, you just want to write, you want to write the script for them. It's like, just... You know, and there's times where I'm like pinching the back of my calf because an interview is so bad.
Yeah.
You know, and you just feel like, God, I just wish I could give them a script because it's so much easier. And that's, you know, and again, it's fine. He does it that way. I just don't want to go that route.
Do you find though that, you know, he's responsible for the one or maybe the top two most profitable documentaries of all time? Do you find that his success has drawn a stronger spotlight on the documentary form?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, Bowling, it was kind of cool with Thoth, was like the year before his big win, and you know, with Bowling, and it made it more popular. And I think what's interesting is now, like, if I don't know if you've seen the Academy Award regulations now, requirements for docs, it's crazy. They've got so many stringent requirements as of this year. And I think what happened is that since documentaries are so popular and people are like, oh, you can make money off of it, everyone's making them.
Yeah.
And so, like, this year with the Academy Awards, like, I had everything lined up, and it was like, okay, the requirements are all done. And then suddenly in April I found out they've added a few more. And so normally for a regular documentary, you have to screen in either L.A. or New York for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And now what they've done is, on top of that, you know, you have to do that by August 31st. You have to be on 14 other screens in 10 different cities in America before November.
Huh.
And that's for a documentary.
That's hard to do.
Uh-huh. and on top of it, this is the part that drove me crazy, because we shot this in HDV. It looks phenomenal. It was a total experiment, and we didn't have to blow it up to 35. I mean, it looks amazing. With the new Academy requirements, if you blow it to 35, you can show it on any crappy projector. It doesn't matter.
Right.
But if it's an HD or HDV, there is a one-of-a-kind projector that you must show it on, and it's $10,000 for the L.A. run. So by the time, just basically as a filmmaker, what it's going to cost, it's right around $34,000 just to fall into the requirements to be in consideration for an Academy Award.
So these new regulations really penalize the...
Well, what happens is, I mean, it literally wipes out 85 to 90% of the competition. I mean, literally, it does, because, you know, most indie film, there's no way. I mean, just for a consideration, I mean, it doesn't mean you're going to even get on the short list.
Mm-hmm.
It just means this is what you have to do, and that's just crazy. I mean, And hardly, and what's really got me was that, because I had my buddy with Ain't It Cool News, I'm like, oh my God, you got to do a piece on this. So he did an article in Ain't It Cool News, and it's weird, like, not many people came up in arms. I mean, it's not like a few years ago when the whole DVD screener thing where the Academy was trying to say you can't send up DVD screeners and, like, killer films, and all of these people were like, that's wrong. That didn't happen on docs, which I'm not sure what that was about. I think it's really odd, because there's going to be so many great docs out there that just won't even get a shot.
Oh, I know. That's horrible. I mean,
yeah, that's a shame. I want to ask you about something else that has probably changed the face of documentary filmmaking, and that's this influx of affordable digital technology. What kind of benefits does that bring to the documentary filmmaker?
Oh, tremendous. I mean, it's amazing. I'm amazed in that, you know, that by shooting digital, like for what we did this JVC 1000 camera.
Mm-hmm.
It was $5,000. The lens is $15,000. It's always the lens. And the tape stock was $20 a pop. So it was like we shot 74 hours of footage, so it was really affordable. It looked amazing. And what's nice is that when you send it out to theaters, if you do in digital houses, it's only costing you between $30 and $50 to be on DVCam, DigiBeta, or HDCam. compared to $2,000 for a print.
Right.
Off of 35. Is that what you were meaning?
Yeah, and I would think too, in terms of the flow of the subjects you're speaking to as well, you don't have to worry about changing a magazine every 20 minutes.
Oh my God, yeah.
There's a flow to it that keeps the project going, I would think.
Yeah, and on this project, and luckily my DP, Anthony Rodriguez, I mean, he lights Mariah Carey, and I always say, if you can make her look good, you're good.
Oh, God.
and he is phenomenal. I mean, there was no color correction needed for the film.
Wow.
There was none whatsoever.
Wow.
And which says a lot. I mean, it's all about lighting, but on the HDV, it's this JVC HDV, it's so amazing because it looks 35 because you have that HD clarity, but not the coldness. And it regulates itself where there's this filmy quality on people's faces, so it has this 35 millimeter feel to it.
Yeah, that's amazing, and that's what we've been waiting for forever, an affordable alternative to 35.
Yeah, but see, but now since everyone can afford this stuff, that's when the Academy and I know what it is too. You know, it's like anybody, you know, especially for the documentary committee, it's like you get all these submissions, and it's like, oh, you know, I really don't want to watch all these films. And I can see it like that, where it's like they're getting so many submissions now that it just needs to trim it back.
Yeah.
Which to me is just, it's almost like with film festivals, because I know film festivals, they don't watch an entire film like that are submitted. And I just find that kind of sad, because as a filmmaker, it's like, you know, we put a lot of work into it. I know sometimes people make some really crappy films and they should know it. But I don't know, a film festival relies on the films as much as the filmmaker relies on a film festival. It's just like, watch it. Just watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the Academy is like, you know, this is our life. And, you know, it's like we're not in this for the money, that's for sure. You know, and it's kind of like, you know, you should at least have that respect to watch these films. It's like, why else are you on the Academy Awards committee?
Absolutely.
That's what you're doing, you know, and that kind of bugs me. Is when they treat it like, they start to treat it like, oh, I don't, you know, it's a bothersome thing.
Yeah, and do you get
obviously, well, I'll probably never be on the board of the Academy.
We're ruining your chances, guys.
I don't know.
You want to be, though? That's the question.
Well, one distributor I had been in talks with, you know, before Halo, it was like, you know, when I talked about, oh, you know, Ana Cornish, they're going to do this article, do you want to talk? And it was just like, oh, no, be careful of what you say, you may, you know, and it's just like, well, I'm not saying, you know, I'm not saying anything rude, I'm just questioning why, you know, and that seems to always get me in trouble anyway, it's like, just why?
Yeah.
You know, and it just doesn't make, when it doesn't make sense, I don't understand it. And the thing is, though, too, is for documentary shorts, new requirements are hard on them too. That you have to be in, you have to screen in 6 other cities for a doc short. And what that does is, no studio is, you know, with studios, if they put out a documentary short, they're going to be like, you know, screw it, it's not worth it. You're not, you know, doc shorts don't make money. And with the new requirements, it's almost, I have a feeling what it's going to do, it's going to wipe that category out.
Yeah,
just
probably
because,
so.
Just because it's kind of like, it's not worth it for a documentary short.
Mm.
You know, and that's the sad part, is when you start to see these things happening, and what's again, it's frustrating when the industry isn't reacting more, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, in terms of your film.
Back to the, yeah, what are we on again?
I'm sorry. We have 5 minutes left, and I have to close on your film. What kind of reactions have you had from the PETA organization and from the audiences?
PETA's never said a word. I've had people who are PETA members, you know, usually the first question at any festival I do Q&A is like, well, you seemed a little harsh on PETA. And I explained, well, if they had gone ahead and done the, you know, gone through with the interview, because they originally agreed, it was Ingrid Newkirk too, and then they declined. And since I can't, you know, I'm not going to put my opinion in and try to balance out the PETA section.
Mm-hmm.
If they had talked, I think that would have balanced out to explain some of the things. Like, even I'm curious. Like, some of the things that are in the film, I would love to know the answer.
Right.
You know, it's just, you know, and that was my frustration. And I think, and during the filming, what was happening is that a lot of PETA supporters were being told, don't talk to this guy. So it was like shooting yourself in the foot, because since I had no supporters for PETA would talk, it was like there was really nothing positive to be able to have anyone say about PETA.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and that's why I was like, oh, they kind of shot themselves in the foot on that one. And I think what they thought, I think, again, when you do like a kind of a blacklisting and telling people don't talk to this guy, most people will go away, and I'm kind of like that little pit bull where I just kind of keep like, I'll show you.
Yeah, and it really raises red flags, too.
Yeah,
if you refuse cooperation or comment.
I lost 13 interviews in 3 days, and that was, in 2 weeks into filming, I'm like, this film's gone. It's over.
From their influence?
I don't want to say yes, it was, but I would get emails from these people saying, well, so-and-so told me not to take part in your film. It's not going to be objective, because that's what I was hearing, like, is that it wasn't going to be objective. Even Humane Society of the United States said, well, you said your film's going to be objective, and it's not. And, of course, all the reviews, that's what they're stating. And it's like, I told you.
How long was this process?
Filming?
When you finished.
From starting of shooting to the rough cut and edit, it was 5 months. I mean, it was a real, we covered 17 states in 90 days. Of interviews, 74 hours of interviews, amazing. Like Tippi Hedren ended up on the cutting room floor. We had so many celebrities.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was a lot of stuff.
She's very passionate about animal rights.
Yeah, well, she has a big cat sanctuary. I mean, they've got, like, lions, all really, like, big, big, big cats. That's her whole sanctuary.
Also Bridget Bardot.
Well, she does Sea Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
You've not seen the film, right?
No, we haven't.
No, I haven't seen it.
Well, Sea Shepherd they're the ones that go out and fight, I guess it's the illegal commercial whaling, and they go out, they ram boats.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of wild. I mean, so Bridget Bardot, she is a big supporter, along with Persia White from Girlfriends, are big supporters of Paul Watson. And even Pierce Brosnan, too.
Really?
And Martin Sheen, yeah, they're big supporters of him, yeah.
Mm. So, is there a wider release plan? What kind of cities is your film going to?
Right now, it just got extended another week in San Francisco. The weekend turned out good, and August it hits all. It spreads throughout Canada. In September, it hits bigger in the United States with colleges coming back, and then it goes out on DVD November 13th.
Oh, November 13th. Well,
yeah.
When you have your DVD release, will you come back to us and talk to us a little bit more about your film? And it's
the DVD extras are going to be pretty crazy. We've got so much.
Well, we've got to talk about that then.
Okay.
I look very much forward to it. Thank you so much for being on our show tonight.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Good night. That's Kurt Johnson, writer-director of Your Mommy Kills Animals, another great title for a film, very provocative. So guys, what do you think? Are we looking forward to these films?
I would say so, yeah.
And Chris, you love Jaws.
I do love Jaws, yeah.
And how you've been hearing about this the shark is still working for probably as long as I have.
Yeah, Ain't It Cool News just had an article about it last week.
Yeah.
And, my first reaction was, what the hell? I mean, like, Jaws, DVDs have come out. There have been all kinds of documentaries about this movie. So it's like, why make another one? But it sounds like after hearing these guys talk, it's like, well, I definitely want to see it.
I made sure to ask, because there has been good work, and they readily admit that. But this is an all-encompassing look at the legacy of Jaws and how it's resounded throughout the world.
Very important.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those movies like Casablanca or Citizen Kane that's just going to go on. There's always going to be more and more coming out about it because that's how good it is.
Yeah.
So.
It's timeless.
Yeah, it really is. We'll be back with you guys on Sunday. And once again, our next tribute show is going to be dedicated to our finest character actors, the ones that you might not know by name, but you know their face, and they're so great in every film they do. They elevate anything that they're in. So if you have any suggestions for that show and who we should pay tribute to, we're compiling our own list too, believe me. Just run it by us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com, and your choice might be one of them that make the final cut. So we're going to leave you guys tonight. Our archive listeners will be able to hear this bonus clip. It's a clip from an interview that we did with the director and one of the participants of the Camden 28, which was this Vietnam War protest group, which consisted mostly of members from the Catholic left. And they went into a New Jersey draft board office and burned as many files as they could, destroyed as many files as they could. And they were brought to trial and acquitted, which is the first time that that's ever happened in history. It's an amazing movie. It's the most movie.
Way to ruin the ending for us, Jamie.
Yeah, really, man.
Well, it's public record. And it's not the ending of the movie. I know. It's so moving. It's the best movie that I've seen this year. It opens this weekend at Cinema Village in New York City. So we're going to close tonight with a clip from that. You can hear the whole thing on the link on our MySpace page. Fellas, we're out of time.
Okay. Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Right.
Were you trying to use this as sort of a mirror for what's going on today? Like Altman's MASH is basically really about the Vietnam War, not Korea.
Right.
Right. And were you trying to say something about the events of today?
No. Well, I mean, I think it ended up that way.
Oh, of course,
that wasn't the intent. The intent was to tell the story of the Camden 28 because we started the film in 1996.
Right, right.
So, and it always had been to tell their story. And then as world events and history sort of, you know, changed around us, it just was looking more and more like the same situation.
It does. It's very interesting because I was thinking about this earlier today. Back, I guess it must have been in the early 90s, Francis Fukuyama wrote the famous book, The End of History,
saying
that basically everything was over.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, September 11th comes along and blows that out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was, you know, well, even if there was nothing going on today, it's obviously a very interesting story, and I applaud you for bringing it to everyone's attention because before Jamie brought this up, I had never heard of it.
Right.
And I can't wait to see it.
Well,
but
I'll just tell you that in the beginning, when I would say 95% of it or so was shot, and the first sort of go at the editing of putting the story together, it was a question in my mind of how much I should bring in the question of Iraq, because I had been to a number of these anti-war rallies leading up to the Iraq War before the war started.
Right.
With them, and so the very first time I actually put something together, that was in there. But then we just decided afterwards just to keep it with the story itself.
No, I applaud that.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, and then that was the end of it. And at the end of the film, when you sort of get an update of what they're doing now, you see them at the rallies.
That's good.
But that was put in there really just to show that they're still out there, that they still are making statements about this.
And I think even without the mention of the Iraq War by name, a viewer today, it's still the parallels are still constantly running in their mind as they're watching your film.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Extremely relevant for this time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, when we were at the Philadelphia Film Festival, and we had a little reception afterwards across the street, that was the most asked question. People would come up to me. They've just seen the movie and say, do you see connection or parallel between what's going on today and what was going on in Vietnam? And, you know, I just felt like carrying a sign around saying, yes, you know.
Yeah, but I think
everybody
that's good.
Was
that's good,
me.
Though. That's good that people make the connection.
Oh, yeah. And some very young people. There are a lot of college kids here, of course. And, yeah, they were asking.